He tapped his lenses to infrared and felt his hopes dampen. They were reading empty. Another burst of plasma seared in. This time, Farron and his brothers were ready for it and got clear just before the sphere obliterated the stanchions behind. Sergeant Orenst and his squadmates had finally made the gantry, levelling their bolt rifles and sending a tight volley into the rain. Once more, a swarm of intercepting firefly things appeared from nowhere to meet them. The bolts lit up the night once more, their wrath as futile as the rain itself.
"Thrun!"
said Farron, motioning at the Promethium drum some way back along the gantry.
"Grab one of those barrels and hurl it out there!"
He ran some preliminary ballistics in his head.
"I can get it some of the way, Lieutenant, but do it!"
Thrun's name rune flashed in acknowledgement on Farron's helm display as the young warrior pounded over to the stack of barrels, manhandling one from the top before dropping it with a clang and taking another.
"They're empty," he said. "They'll still have the dregs and traces of gas. It won't reach the... It doesn't need to. Just get one out there."
Another ball of plasma hurtled towards them. This time, Morricani and his team were ready, sending a volley of their own superheated energies from their plasma incinerators to blaze straight into the incoming shot. Farron heard Morricani laugh harshly as the air turned to spectacular inferno. His auto-sensors kicked in, dimming his lenses to keep him from being blinded entirely.
"Now!"
Spinning around on the spot like a Medusan hammer thrower, Thrun whirled the heavy iron drum before releasing it with a roar. Farron knelt and took a bead as it curved through the air towards the site of the stealth's plasma discharge.
"Maximum yield, brothers," said Morricani, "and make ready."
Farron heard the telltale whine of the plasma guns reaching their highest output, a lethal risk in any situation, even for those as scrupulous in their maintenance rituals as the Hellblasters.
"On my mark," said Farron.
He mouthed a silent prayer to the Omnissiah, running his index finger along his gun's barrel to calm its machine spirit. His bolt rifle bucked as he took the shot. It struck the Promethean barrel dead center, the armor-piercing bolt punching straight through. With a deafening crack, the Promethean vapor ignited, and the barrel came apart in a puff of flame. Splintered wedges of metal burned in all directions. Once more, the Firefly countermeasures of the Xenos stealther shot out, this time flitting to intercept the knives of shrapnel coming towards it. Illuminated by the flame of the detonation, the colossal warsuit had been made visible, a giant of smooth lines and glinting sensors.
"Fire!"
said Farron. The Xenos thing moved to evade, but with its countermeasures already launched, it had no way to escape. The bolts fired by Farron and his brothers struck hard, each piercing shot punching through alien alloy to detonate with a loud boom. Smoking craters appeared in the machine's hull. A moment later, Squad Morricani's blinding spheres of plasma energy struck the warsuit, burning away its front and melting its primary weapon limb to a drizzling, shapeless mass. The machine, mortally stricken and with flame jetting from within its cockpit, toppled back from its perch into the heaving waves below. Farron cast about himself, looking for signs of any Xenos threat. The storm howled, but of the battle unfolding around the rig, he saw nothing.
"And so it goes," said Morricani. "Score one for the Hellblasters."
The lieutenant tapped his lenses through every spectrum available, scanning for Tau presence. Though he could not see him nearby, Pavel would no doubt have taken off his helm by now, trusting his own senses to scan for more stealthers. Yet even he remained silent.
"Eastern Quadrant neutralized, Chaplain," said Farron over the macrovox. "Your orders?"
There was still no reply. Baring his teeth in irritation, Farron made his way out onto a jutting girder. He pushed out until he felt the strain of the metal underneath him near its optimum tolerance. Part of the rig's core armature it was built to last, but after the blazing energies of their fight with a warsuit, he did not push his luck too far. Something caught his eye to the far left, vanishing from sight. Farron frowned, risking another step out on the stanchion. It shuddered under his feet, a warning from the primitive spirit of the rig itself. He increased his mag clamps to maximum as the wind howled around him, each new gust tugging and pushing at him as he took the best vantage point he could. Steeling himself, he raised his bolt rifle to his shoulder and readied to jump back if the stanchion gave way. It would not help the Primaris strike force's already shaky command structure to see their lieutenant plunge down into the icy water. Peering down the scryoscope to the far left of their position, Farron made out a group of bone-armored figures. Each was massive in bulk, and several were adorned with the tall feathered wing pennants of the First's elite. The squad had taken up a full circle firing stance as it was lowered into the sea by a winch platform on the western pontoon. The Deathwing, fabled First Company of the Dark Angels, were seeking to engage beneath the waves. Farron frowned, theories clustering in his head as he watched them descend to the base of the pontoon and down into the surging waves. They were still standing in weapons-ready position as the crashing waters closed over them. Before long, all he could make out was their armor lumens dimly glowing in the sea. Then, even those were gone. The sound of explosions came from the west. Lashing flames curled around the stanchions from a clash happening just out of sight. Then the macrovox crackled, laced with a fizzle of static but still intelligible.
"Primaris elements," came the voice of Chaplain Zaroff. "You have done well. The Xenos are in full retreat. Return to your transports and extract forthwith."
"Acknowledged," said Farron. Another explosion sounded from the west, this time a muffled thump that sent up a plume of water. Farron opened the macrovox line again.
"Forgive me, Chaplain Zaroff, but it appears elements of our wider force are still engaged. Should we reinforce the Deathwing?" "Return to your transports and extract immediately."
The chaplain's tone had a note of rage that took Farron aback.
"Understood. Heading for rendezvous point now."
The lieutenant heard indistinct voices over the vox, muffled ghosts that he could not discern. Then Zaroff's voice came through once more.
"Farron, you are to attend us in the octagonal chamber at the rig's pinnacle."
"Aye, chaplain."
"Alone."
"Acknowledged."
Farron motioned for his men to move out, but did not go with them. Marikani raised an eyebrow, but he waved his brother's concern away.
"Later, Pieter. I have a report to make."
Within seconds, the Primaris Marines were retracing their steps. The lieutenant cast a glance over his shoulder as he left the gantry, staring back at the crashing waves where he had seen his Deathwing battle brothers submerge. Only the black depths, profound with unanswered questions, greeted his gaze.
Chapter 2. Cold Thoughts. Ferrogiant Network, Salt Eye of X, Pelagic Industrial World, Chalnath Expanse.
Jensa Deal was sodden and numb with exhaustion. She was free of the water at last, having climbed out of the stormy ocean up one of the rig's main stanchions with the last of her strength. She was not free of the rising tide of panic that threatened to consume her mind. Her teeth chattered violently enough for her jaws to clack, like those of a skeletal marionette. She clung to the stanchion of the Promethean rig as tightly as she could, the sharp-spined shells of zebra limpets cutting into her fingers and wrists. But she was alive. Through sheer animal adrenaline and through the inner strength of a lifetime spent braving the waters during her down cycles, she had made the journey from Omicroid without drowning. Less than a few hours earlier, she had plunged from the crosshairs of a Xenos gun into the stormy waters. The gambit had worked, for the takers that attacked her had left her for dead. Perhaps they weren't so far off the mark. She had been a prime target for the remora-mouthed sapres that writhed in the surf, having to kick them off her legs as best she could, even as she swam. She had lost a lot of blood, and likely had the cold ague at the very least. Given the number and depth of the wounds, scrapes, and gashes she had sustained in the last few hours, she might not last the night, but for now, at least, she clung on. Jensa forced herself to look upwards and assess the outside of the rig. The oval hollows in the outside of the stanchion led up higher than she could see, their height seemingly infinite as they stretched away into the rain. The priestess imagined a warm bed with a dozen blankets and stretched a shuddering hand up to the first metal hollow in the stanchion's side. Then she reached her other hand up to the second. It took her three tries to force the toe of her boot into another of the hollows below, but she made it and pushed upwards to grab a solid grip.
"You can do it, Jensa," stuttered the rigs woman, her throat thick with the acrid, salty taste of seawater. "Done it 100 times before."
Muscle memory took over, her limbs so cold and tired that the pain in her joints and the back of her thighs was almost abstract. Some animalistic need for survival took over, and her movements became almost automatic. One hollow blended into the next. A deep black sleep threatened to snatch her away and drop her into the waters at any moment. Half blind with tiredness, Deel allowed herself a moment of rest. She locked her limbs into the hollows, pushing her thigh all the way through to sit half astride. She wedged her shoulder into the hollow above, just as she'd been trained to do on the first day of her indoctrination. She hung there like a rag doll, head drooping. The only thing keeping her awake was the cold rain lashing her face. She knew she was still losing blood from the wounds on her legs. The freezing sea had caused her veins to contract to the point it would likely be a mere trickle, but if she opened them up too much, she would probably bleed out.
"Tava, spare me," she whispered into the storm. "Tava, give me strength."
For a second, she fell into the sleep of the dead. A geyser of water erupted from the sea near the northern siphon point, waking her up with a jolt. A black shape burst from its midst in a manner that reminded Jensa of a spine whale breaching. With its wings swept in the manner of a soaring raptor, it roared up into the skies on twin trails of flame. She could make out two blunt cannons jutting from the cockpit. Trails of blue sparks crackled across one of its wings around a crater of battle damage that fizzed with energy. Jensa watched it with a numb detachment. There was no such craft on her rig, nor the ones either side of it. Nothing happened on Ferrogiant Omicroid without her permission, and little on the other rigs without her getting word of it. But right now, such concerns seemed 1,000 years away. There was a sky-splitting boom, and suddenly there were more black shapes jetting overhead. The din of their engines rose above the crash and thunder of the tempest. Three squadrons of three fighters, stylized pinions emblazoned across their wings, carved through the skies after the unknown craft, like carrion crows pursuing a great black eagle. As they matched their prey's flight path, the fleeing craft shimmered and disappeared from sight entirely. Deel frowned. The vessel that had burst from the water had been nowhere near the cloud banks. If anything, it had been heading for a gap in the Thunderheads, its flight path leading it straight for the star she knew as the Scorpid's Eye. So how did it just disappear? She felt the roar of the jet fighters reverberate in her chest as they engaged their afterburners. They drove hard along the same vector, then peeled off, three by three, before splitting up in a rising spiral that reminded her of a cyclone gathering force. A search pattern, unmistakably. She was not the only one to have lost the first craft's trail. The jet fighters hurtled up into the storm clouds and were gone. Jensa Deel finally hauled herself onto the lowest dwelling level of the rig. Still dripping, she sprawled on her face onto the cold metal, eyes closed and too tired to cry. She could hear the dull clang of footsteps, and they were getting louder. Only through the most tremendous act of willpower did she manage to push herself onto all fours. She opened her eyes to see two massive armored boots. Their royal blue hue was so dark they seemed almost black, and they glinted with amber spots in the orange light of the sub-level. They were far too large to be those of a human. Deel blinked, gathered herself, and stood shakily. Adrenaline pounded in her neck, her chest, her spine, as she took in the barrel chest and hulking, bear-like mass of an Imperial Space Marine. She felt like a shivering child next to the immense armor-clad figure that stood before her, as impassive as a statue. The low hum of its power armor thrummed under the sound of distant waves. Deel could feel its gaze upon her, its disapproval mixed with idle interest. She was suddenly aware that, in some other circumstances, some animal part of her would have cowered, shrinking away from the terrifying apparition. But right now, she was too tired to do anything more than exist and get to shelter by whatever means necessary. The adrenaline rushing through her system, by this point feeling stagnant and spiky rather than invigorating, made her feel more willing to fight than flee. It would mean less movement, for one thing. Even though spots of exhaustion danced in front of her eyes, she forced herself to look up and meet its gaze. A hooded figure stared back, as deathly and stern as if the Reaper had come for her himself. Only the lower half of the Space Marine's face was exposed, a jutting jaw made rough with dark stubble, but as her eyesight adjusted, she could see a little way under its cowl. Strange cables framed the giant's angular features. His eyes, narrow and slitted against the wind, seemed to glow coldly in the shadows. She felt as though they bored into the center of her brain.
Deal,
he said, the word as sepulchral and deep as the Black Sea.
Yes, she chattered.
You will come with me back to Omicroid.
Zedro Farron stood in the octagonal viewing room at the top of the Promethean rig. Opposite him were two of the most senior members of the Dark Angels chapter, imposing even to one who had witnessed Archmagos call in the flesh. Light flickered from the cage lumens above, casting them all in a wan blue tint. Around him were cogitator banks and wide panoramic windows that showed the storm-racked ocean beyond. Ferrogiant Omicroid's fellow rigs dotted the horizon, churning excess power from the ocean to send tongues of flame into the night. Farron's gaze was firmly fixed upon his fellow Dark Angels. Solid figures in ornate power armor, their presence and gravitas seemed to take up far more room than any mortal could ever hope to fill. Chaplain Zeroff's face was hidden behind a stylized skull helmet, grim and forbidding. Around his neck was a sacred rosarius, the force field amulet held on a string of pearled beads. For some reason, three of them were black, but Farron had never mustered the nerve to ask why. Even with his features covered, the chaplain managed to exude a disapproval so intense it felt like it stripped a layer of paint from Farron's armor with every glance. Company Master Gabriel did not wear his helm, instead reinforcing his status with a long and elaborately embroidered cloak. He stared at Farron with an even and passionless expression, the stolid intensity of a castellan watching foes approach his fortress before giving the order to fire. The deep brown of his skin was that of a soul well used to fighting under a harsh sun. Three golden service studs in the shape of skulls jutted from his forehead in stark contrast, glinting in the flickering light beneath a receding hairline of cropped black hair. Farron knew he was more physically imposing than the veteran Dark Angels officers he was reporting to, and he was clad in Mark X armor, the finest type of battleplate yet known to the Adeptus Astartes. The implants in his body were superior to those of the traditional space marines, giving him greater endurance and swifter reaction speed. He had coils of hyper-durable metal around every sinew, a Belisarian furnace in his chest, and the blood of the lion pulsing in his veins. More than that, he carried the rank of lieutenant, an honour he had earned twice over. He had nothing to fear from his battle brothers. And still, in the face of the luminaries of his chapter, Farron felt like a boy called to answer to his elders and betters. There was a heaviness to them, the weight of centuries spent in battle. They bore it in their posture, their gaze, even the aura around them. To Farron, they seemed sculpted from stone, with he and his kin mere driftwood by comparison. Their presence was intimidating, even to one used to dealing with the half-human magi of the Adeptus Mechanicus.
"May I tell you of our fight?" said Farron,
his voice coming out not nearly as strident and confident as he had hoped.
"It will be of interest." "You may not," snapped Zeroff. "We await the return of Epistolary Dothrail," said Gabriel,
his eyes looking sidelong out the viewscreen window, as if Farron was barely worthy of notice.
"His gunship just made it back to the sky shield."
Farron kept his peace. In his mind's eye, he saw Morricani laughing at him. How glad he was that his battle brother had not been asked along to the debriefing.
"He is here,"
said Zeroff, turning to the doorway. A gale of cold wind burst through the seal hatch as the epistolary flung it open, his massively built form holding the worst of the elements at bay. His eyes glowed blue, tiny traceries of lightning at each corner. Shoved roughly before him was a human female, long-limbed and muscular of build, but small in comparison to her saviour. She staggered in, dropping to one knee with a grunt of pain. The human was already half dead by the look in her eye and the chattering of her teeth. Farron surreptitiously tapped his helm to infrared. Her life signs were pitifully low. Even her core was barely registering amber levels of heat.
"This is the survivor," said Zeroff.
"Yes, interrogator chaplain,"
said Dothrail, the wind tugging at his cowl as he shut the bulkhead door behind him.
"Rigswoman Jensa Deal. Somehow she made it to the next rig."
Farron frowned at the librarian's term of address. Interrogator?
"She is the only human still active from this megastructure, according to the Raven Wing,"
said Master Gabriel, his cloak of office billowing around him in the last of the wind.
Just as well.
Zeroff snorted through his helmvox, a sound like that of an impatient stallion.
Stand up, mortal. Let me assess you.
The bedraggled human stood as tall as she could, her fists bunched and arms shaking.
Get what, woman? Said the chaplain, moving in close to stare down at her with red-lit eyes.
Get to the sea's bed with you.
To Farron, she looked on the point of despair, or madness. Her shivering was uncontrollable, almost hard to watch.
Or get her a blanket,
he said, despite himself.
What did you say?
Said Gabrielle, his tone incredulous.
We are not nursemaids. Your kind is clearly too naive to realize it, Farron, but compassion is a weakness. If she dies on us, it will be next to impossible to unpick what happened here, said Farron, his tone level. We will have the answers we need before she expires, said Zeroff.
Next to him, the company master turned and looked out of the window, already disinterested. Farron moved over to Gabrielle and grabbed his heavy cloak, yanking it so hard it tore away from the clasps on his shoulders with a loud rip. The company master spun, his face a mask of indignant fury. His power sword was already halfway from its skullwork scabbard, glowing blue with a crackle of disruptive energies. Zeroff's hand shot out and grabbed the company master by the wrist, holding his sword arm in place. The chaplain fixed Gabrielle with an even stare, daring him to lash out. Farron turned away without a word, wrapping the heavy cloak around the shivering woman until she was covered head to toe, with only her face visible. She looked up at him, gratitude mingled with shock in her eyes, as she pulled the velvety fabric in close.
That cloak once swayed the relic of the chapter's past, said Gabrielle,
his voice cold and monotone.
You will answer for that. The matter can wait, said Zeroff. Farron is correct. The woman is more used to as alive and intelligible than as a corpse.
Farron cast about the room, eyes alighting on a bullet flask wedged in between two of the cogitator banks. He walked over, ignoring Gabrielle's dagger stare as he pulled the flask out and unscrewed the cap. He held it under his respirator for a moment. It had the bitter tang of recaf mixed with the ester-rich scent of moonshine. Bad quality and poisonous in the long term, but clearly the riggers found it warming enough.
Here, he said, handing it to the woman. Drink this.
She took it with shaking hands, sipping at first, then gulping it down. She coughed hard, spat a thin gruel of seawater and moonshine onto the steel floor, and pulled the cloak tight once more.
My thanks, she stammered. But really, I need something hot.
Why must we suffer this nonsense? Blurted Gabrielle. Time is of the essence. However fast we pursue, we will not outdistance the Ravenwing, said Zeroff. Let them do what they were born to. We shall find plenty of answers here, said Epistolary Dothrail, even if we have to resort to unusual methods to find them.
I'm glad to hear it, said Farron. I have many questions.
The room went silent. Its atmosphere suddenly growing so cold that Farron half expected to see his breath frosting in front of his face.
Let him ask, said the librarian. We may gain some insight into the Primaris mindset, or perhaps even that of his ultimate sponsor, the Lord McCrag. Besides, after we get back to the Blade, what difference will it make?
There is that, said Gabrielle. Perhaps it is the teachings of Gilliman that leads him to disrespect the sons of the Lion, stealing the belongings of his superiors and giving them to human serfs. Is that how the Primarch told you to behave when you met him, Primaris?
It is the faultless logic of Mars, combined with the human decency of Terra, said Farron. We still have some of that left.
As Gabrielle gave a short, barking laugh at the implied rebuke, questions blurred together in Farron's mind. What had the company master meant about meeting the Primarch? And what events were due to take place on the Blade? He had heard nothing.
Enough, said Zeroff. Report, whilst this one gathers herself.
My teams engaged the Xenos at the southern pontoon, said Farron. We took the first story with ease before encountering resistance from our stealth team.
Fascinating, said Gabriel, dully.
Let him speak, said Zeroff. Did you learn of their modus?
They struck as and when the opportunity presented itself, placing themselves in commanding ballistic positions. They relied on their adaptive camouflage to shield them from return fire. In this lies their weakness.
Go on.
They use the mindset of the ambush predator, Chaplain. Yet we are not prey. They little realize that if they do not kill us when they have the advantage, they invite a far deadlier retribution.
How many Xenos fell to your teams? Asked Gabriel.
5 warsuits in all. The company master snorted, turning away once more to look out at the ocean beyond. The last of them we engaged was some 30 feet tall and cloaked with such sophisticated tech it was all but invisible. It had an ionic plasma weapon of some kind, judging by its proton yield, and countermeasures that intercepted our bolt rounds with ease.
So, how did you kill it? Asked Dothrael. You Primaris Marines forsake heavy weapon troopers, do you not?
We have squads intended for engaging heavy targets. I improvised, occupied its countermeasures, and coordinated a dual strike with Sergeant Morricani that sent it below the waves.
Hmm, said Zeroff. At least you kept one heavy warsuit occupied then.
We killed it, said Farron, whereas the Raven Wing, tasked with perimeter control, were nowhere to be seen.
The Raven Wing's business is their own, said Gabriel. And you do not know that you killed it if you merely saw it submerge.
On the subject of submerging, said Farron, I saw members of the Death Wing descend into the water on a winch rig. When I offered my team's assistance, you refused on their behalf. May I ask, in my capacity as the commanding officer of the Primaris contingent, what they were hoping to accomplish?
No,
said Zeroff.
We are discussing the Xenos presence and their capabilities, said Epistolary Dothrael. Did you encounter any anomalies you could not explain?
Not from the Xenos, said Farron, giving Zeroff a long stare. The chaplain remained impassive.
Although the site where we fought the macro-stealther looked as if it had been cut apart by an industrial lascutter, wielded more or less at random, continued Farron. Whole sections of the rig were slashed away and still glowing.
Farron saw the human female glance up at this, but she looked away as soon as she felt his gaze.
Anything else? Said Gabriel.
The lieutenant called up the picked captures he had assembled over the course of the battle, coming to rest on the image of the fallen riggers that had fired upon them with Xenos weaponry.
On 2 occasions we encountered resistance from indigenous humans, once deep within the rig, and once on its outskirts. The first group were put down efficiently. A vision of Enrod's bolt detonating within an unarmored human's neck filled Farron's mind. He was not sure he would ever forget the sight. When they had been shooting servitors on Mars, that had been different somehow. Those things were half dead already, their true sentience long gone.
And the second? Said Gabriel.
The second group we intended to subdue for questioning, he continued. But they fought hard, and we were forced to put them down too.
Such is the cost of war.
Farron was about to mention the strange sculpture he had found in the bundle of the knife thrower's belongings, but something in Gabriel's contemptuous tone made him keep that to himself. He had no desire to feel the lash of the company master's tongue again.
One of them, on the brink of death, manifested some psychic ability, said Farron, seemingly spontaneous and uncontrolled. Telekinesis, I believe, and some manner of biomancy that sent a beam of white energy from the mouth.
You slew this creature,
said Dothrael, leaning forward with his expression intense.
Immediately, said Farron. Summary decapitation. Did any of your men come into physical contact with the ectoplasmic discharge?
No, said Farron, putting aside the ghosts of pain that still ached in his flank from the psyker's beam. The answer was technically correct. After all, he was the commander of the unit, rather than a part of it. Dothrael nodded solemnly.
She was probably an unsanctioned witch that had come here for refuge, he said. It is well she is dead,
and the matter is closed.
Odd, thought Farron. He had not told the librarian the gender of the psycho.
There was one other thing that made little sense to me, said Farron, eyes spooling back through his picked captures.
He picked out the pict of a Tau corpse, four-fingered hand clutching at the air. He summoned the pict of a discarded Tau rifle lying near a dead rigger and compared them against each other.
Well, said Dothrail, one of the riggers we encountered used a rifle of Xenos make. I assumed he'd recovered it from an alien corpse, and in his panic he was on the brink of using it against us. But its grip was for a five-fingered hand.
The roots of heresy penetrate further than ever since the rift, said Zeroff. But theft is a minor crime compared to rebellion.
That's just it. The Tau are quadridactylous, four-fingered. I checked one of the cadavers up close.
Is this babble relevant, said Gabriel, or are you further wasting our time?
Have some respect, sighed Farron. I am a Dark Angel too, and an officer at that. You may outrank me, Company Master Gabriel, but one of the Adeptus Astartes should not talk to a fellow officer in that manner.
Fellow officer, said Gabriel, incredulous. The only thing you and I have in common, brother, is the colour of our battle plate. To my mind, you Mars-loving bastards do not deserve even that.
The Lieutenant's report is relevant,
said Epistolary Dothrail.
And his perspicacity does him credit.
He turned to the shivering human woman, staring down at her.
Jenser Deal, did the populace of your rig ever treat with Xenos ambassadors and accept weapons customized for human use? Do not lie to me, for I shall know of it.
We did,
she said, her voice quavering.
And was this something that was common to the planet of Saltire Vex?
Deal said nothing, staring up at the librarian with a mixture of defiance and terror.
Answer him, said Zeroff, or he will rip the knowledge from your mind and leave you a drooling cretin for the rest of your short life.
Stricken, she looked over at Farron.
Comply, he said.
We sent our message boats decades ago, she said coldly, her jaw jutting out. Even manned shuttles when we had the chance, and sent them to Karunon. We got nothing. The astropaths wouldn't even see us.
And?
The Imperium ignored our calls for medicine, for supplies, vitae paste, fresh blood, everything. We had epidemics of bone twist, of rickets, and outbreaks of ulcers inside and out. Even the supply ships stopped coming to take away the promethium we mined from the seabed. What's the point of mining if it's just going to get stockpiled and never used?
Deal seemed to be warmed by her anger. Some of the colour was returning to her cheeks, and her stutter was gone.
If it is your duty to mine it, then I do not see the issue, said Farron.
We can't turn the machines off. Our warehouse levels are packed to capacity. We're so overloaded, we have to burn the stuff off each night, or we'd be drowning in it.
And that is cause to betray the Emperor, said Chaplain Zeroff. To flee into the arms of Xenos scum.
He took a step forward, his fists clenched at his sides, and leaned forward, as if he were about to bite her.
You are already lost, human.
We had no choice, said Deal, her voice high. Without them, without Tauvach, we would all be dead. This world's population would be nothing more than floating corpses.
Better that than Xenos sympathizers, said Gabriel coldly. You will die a traitor, and your kin will be put to death, but not until we have wrung every last iota of information we need from your worthless mind.
I mean no disrespect, but you don't understand what we went through, said Deal. The Imperium is blind to Saltire Vex. It has forgotten we exist. And why? We have our tithes ready, and the Imperium needs fuel more than ever to wage its wars. So why are we being left to starve?
The galaxy is a big place, said Farron. Sometimes mistakes are made.
Some comfort that is. With the Emperor's light taken from us, we can't possibly hope to survive. Malnutrition is one thing, but there's not much to do out here at night but stargaze. And there's something new in the sky, isn't there? That great purple scar.
It is forbidden to look upon it, said Dothrail. Even you must know that.
I'm not surprised. Those who stared at it too long, they lost their minds. We had outbreaks of violent psychosis every month, then every week. We know what's in store for us here. Without the Tau's help, we would have wound up eating each other when the food ran out, and even then the survivors would freeze to death.
How so? Asked Farron. With that much excess promethium, surely fire is not a problem.
This planet's orbit takes us far from the sun, said Deal. Barrel fire's not nearly enough to keep that kind of cold at bay. The Great Cycle, we call it. In the past, the Adepts have always evacuated us, taking us off-world. They resettle the rigs once the cold time is over. But there's no reply to our data psalms. No talk of evacuation now. Not this time.
The Emperor has more pressing concerns, said Zeroff dryly. What does he care if a world of Xenos-worshipping heretics dies out?
You aren't listening. Without a way off-world, another 5 months go past and we'll have all frozen to death or else gone mad and killed one another, said Deal. When the Tau came, offering help, what was I supposed to do?
Fight them to the last drop of blood and then die in the Emperor's grace, said Gabriel with a half shrug. Only in death does duty end.
An industrial outpost world can't hold out against an alien empire, said Deal. That's why the Emperor made people like you, to fight on our behalf.
She made a grimace.
A lot of good you did us. The defenders of humanity, indeed.
We saved you from the Xenos that were corrupting you, said Farron, though you yourselves attacked us as we did so. One of your number turned Xenos weaponry against us, and another used some manner of psychic assault.
The lieutenant unconsciously moved his arm to cover his side. The scorched black ceramite clustered around a deep crater that exposed layers of shining alloy and reinforced fiber bundles around a pitted crater of flesh. It looked much like a plasma wound, thank the Omnisire. No one had questioned it thus far, but something about it felt wrong. He could feel the sting of the wound at the crater's center, almost red hot with the process of accelerated healing as his advanced biology went to work.
Those who attack you likely thought you to be takers, said Deal sullenly.
Takers, said Zeroff. Explain this term.
Over the last few months, 34 riggers have gone missing. Usually, whenever the cloud comes in low, or when the storms roll in.
Collateral damage from the tempests, said Zeroff. Such an open structure is bound to take losses.
No. We know how to batten down the hatches. We train for that. This is something else entirely. We are being abducted.
Speak on, said Zeroff.
No one knew how or why or by what. These takers are invisible. They come down from the clouds, seize you, and they take you away. But then I saw one of the things with my own eyes.
They were the same breed of Xenos you claimed had come to save you, said Farron.
Deal looked at the floor.
Yes.
See how your new masters reward you for your compliance, growled Gabriel.
You reap that which you have sown, said Zeroff, nodding. Treat with dark forces, and you will find yourself in the depths of the abyss.
So I see, said Deal, her eyes flashing.
Zeroff, Gabriel, and Dothrael stared at her, saying nothing. She pulled the cloak tight around her once more, seeming to shrink.
Was there any pattern to those taken by the Xenos? Asked Farron.
Yes, said Deal, quietly. The abductees were always those who had experienced splitting headaches beforehand.
Zeroff leaned forward.
Elaborate.
There are those among us who had developed migraines recently, she said, with a shiver. Migraines and memory loss. They were always the ones that were taken. I kept track and marked the registers myself.
She's hiding something, said Dothrael to Zeroff.
Woman, you had better speak the full truth,
said Gabriel. Your time is running out. Farron saw Deal's eyes dart over to him. He nodded just once.
She had these symptoms herself,
said Zeroff, his tone sly.
Yes, she confessed. I had them too. When the Takers came for me, that was when I dived into the water and swam to Thetoid.
An unaugmented human managed to escape a Xenos warsuit.
Something happened. My head felt like it split open. And when I opened my eyes...
Yes?
The warsuit thing had been hit by some kind of weapon.
You mean you had manifested a psychic ability?
Said Dothrail.
All I know is the girders around me had been cut through, and the thing was suddenly visible with two deep gashes across its chest.
Dothrail and Zeroff shared a glance.
The sight I spoke of, said Farron.
It was huge, continued Deal, far larger than any loader armature or sentinel array I'd ever seen. It looked advanced. There were these disc things flying around it, a little like servo skulls, I suppose, but much bigger. But it wasn't moving.
And that is when you ran, said Farron.
Yes. I dived into the water and swam. That's all.
She stared at nothing and spoke as if to herself.
I need to get to a fire. I must go.
Manifesting untrained psychic powers is amongst the most severe transgressions in the Imperium, said Dothrail. So no. You cannot simply go. You will stay under our auspice, said Zeroff, nodding. Somewhere secure and discreet. You are the self-confessed leader of a group of known Tau sympathizers. Having already been the target of one abduction attempt, you will likely be a priority target for whatever force tried to remove you. In short, you make for good bait, said Dothrail.
I have to ask, said Farron. Why did the members of your rig suddenly begin to manifest empiric phenomena? The data slate on these Tau says they are psychically inert.
That is enough in the way of questions for today,
said Zeroff, turning his back on the assembly to gaze out of the window to the rigs on the horizon.
We will learn more soon enough.
But with all due respect, Chaplain, that information could...
Farron, leave us. Return to your squads. Dothrail, you will keep watch over this rigger, somewhere secure, and take any truths she has yet to give us. I expect a full report within the hour. We must rendezvous with the Raven Wing at the muster point once they have seen to their quarry.
Of course, Chaplain Zeroff, said Dothrail.
Interrogator Chaplain, wasn't it? Said Farron. That was what you called him earlier, isn't it? Epistolary Dothrail. Gabriel spoke through his teeth.
It matters little in the end.
Leave us, Farron, said Zeroff,
his tone as cold as buried steel.
Do not make me repeat myself again, or it will go the worse for you.
As you wish, but I would recommend keeping Mademoiselle Deal inside, as close to warm and dry as you can. If possible, you should get Apothecary Vara to see to her.
Zeroff and Gabriel stared long at Farron. The feeling of their dislike was so intense it was almost palpable.
We must honour the tenets of the Lord Macragge, said Dothrail, dully. Of course. Make ready your contingent, Farron, said Zeroff. We will leave this war zone within the hour.
We have business elsewhere, said Company Master Gabriel. You will be briefed at the appropriate juncture. Now is the time to leave.
Farron turned on his heel and made for the door, turning the wheel lock before striding out into the pelting rain. Questions whirled around his brain, but something inside him knew better than to ask them. The wheel lock door slammed shut as Farron left, with Dothrail and Deal close behind him. All disappeared past the viewscreen and made their way down the reinforced iron stairs before Farron peeled off. Inside, Zeroff and Gabriel waited patiently, listening to three sets of retreating footsteps.
Keeping an untrained psyker close at hand, said Gabriel when he was sure no one could hear them. Are you sure that is wise?
It is necessary, said Zeroff. Have some faith.
Gabriel nodded, as if convinced, but he felt the need to finish what he had started.
You truly believe she will lure the Xenos back to us?
Not for an instant, said Zeroff. These Tau are not imbeciles. There is a reason they rely on stealth so heavily. In a straight fight against us, they are hopelessly outmatched.
You think she has value in the wider work, then?
She may have seen our quarry firsthand, even if she does not remember it, replied the chaplain. She may even have been affected by the device. If so, her brain will be of use to us.
Should we have Varad extracted?
No. Dothrael will keep her psyche under control, if necessary, and excise the answers we need after we remove her. You know full well what he is capable of.
Gabriel nodded, looking out of the viewscreens to the storm clouds high above. They were beginning to part in places, revealing the star-studded vault and the livid purple wheel of unreality that cut across it.
Farron is still a dangerous liability, even with the asset in play, he said, after a while. He oversteps his bounds. This tendency is rooted deep in him.
He and his warriors are emblematic of a wider issue, one that gives the Adeptus Astartes new hope, even as it dooms our old ways to obsolescence.
Do you not say yourself that curiosity is an infection? Said Gabriel. One to be quarantined, moved into the vanguard, and dashed against the rocks of duty?
I stand by those words, nodded the interrogator chaplain. Their freedom of thought disturbs me as much as it does you. But the Lord of Ultramar outlined his vision very clearly at the summit, and he watches from afar. This is his initiative.
His initiative with the Primaris Marines as his eyes and ears, said Gabriel. We tempt fate even by allowing them in our sanctums. Let them believe they are part of our chapter for the sake of appearance if you must. But I implore you, Zeroff, send them far away.
Can you not speak with Azrael or contact Ezekiel? Find a way to dispatch these knives to another war zone entirely? You wish for us to deliberately misinterpret the Primarch's wishes, for us to refuse these new bodies. To keep the Ultima Founding from our ranks would be as sure a way to invite the scrutiny of the Lord Imperium as if we directed our guns at Ultramar ourselves. We proceed with the induction program as planned.
I suppose this is not the time to deviate from our course?
No, indeed, said the chaplain, studying the ornate winged skull at the end of his crozier arcanum. We continue the hunt apace.
We have lost him already, said Gabriel. I can feel it.
I, too, have my doubts. But we should not give up hope, lest despair diminish our perception. Our Thunderhawks are still searching the skies, as are the Nephilim, and the rest of the Ravenwing contingent are still tracing his spoor. We may find him on Saltai of X yet, and if not, we will intercept him at his next destination instead.
Do we have an extrapolation of heading, at least?
Apparently so, said Zeroff. And according to the Ravenwing's last communique, the Xenos are following him too. They are bound for the Scorpid cluster. If Autonicus is right, their blasphemous technology has a far greater auger range than ours. They will lead us right to him, and give us all the reason we need to strike at his destination.
Gabriel nodded, deep in thought.
The Scorpid star system is home to the Angels of Absolution's prime homeworld, All Hallow, continued Zeroff. We will trap him there, with our hammer crushing him against the anvil of Soul's Well.
This does not sit well with me, Chaplain, said Gabriel, employing the Xenos in such a fashion.
We came close this time, old friend, very close. If we keep up this pressure, he will overplay his hand soon enough. And then we will seize him.
What of the Rigsmen?
They must be eradicated. The taint must not spread, nor can word of its source.
I agree. But we cannot incur the world fire without censure, even with the express consent of the Supreme Grand Master. We will draw undue attention from the Inquisition.
I realize that, Gabriel, said the chaplain. If it were at all possible, I would already have enacted it.
The populace of this outpost may already have spread to another site, even before we made planetfall and spread the infection with it. And they may have taken incriminating information along with them.
The population is effectively quarantined already by their severance from the astropathic ducts. I have already seen to it that no more communication can be shared between Saltav X and Karu Nun, nor that which remains of the Imperium this side of the rift.
Then the problem will solve itself.
Essentially, yes.
The interrogator turned, the forbidding skull of his helm staring straight at Gabriel.
Within a few months, the people of this world will be little more than statues of frozen flesh.
High above Ferrogiant Thetoid, there was a shimmer in the night sky. It rose high above the thunderclouds and seemed to ripple for a moment. Then the light from the planet's nearest moon caught it fully, playing across swept forward wings and a pair of cannons jutting from a blunt nose cone of jet black. The aircraft was deadly enough in itself, but inside it was a concentration of force like no other.
"They had their chance," said the figure in the cockpit, "and they failed to seize it."
The pilot was a space marine, or at least an approximation of one, tusked in the manner of a beast. A vice-like apparatus of tubes and coils gripped his head, as if holding it together from some grievous wound. The spark plug-like protrusions jutting from his strange crown crackled with black lightning. Around his torso was a chain-link necklace of 8 rune-emblazoned skulls, each large and broad of brow. They were yellow-brown with age, and each had a patina of cracked shellac varnish. Seawater dripped from the gappy teeth of the most intact skulls, and small rivulets sloshed from the empty sockets of the one at the bottom of the chain. To a simple man, the skulls were a grisly adornment, unsettling but crude. To one with the witch sight, they would appear as threatening as a string of time bombs, primed and ready to explode. The cockpit smelt of salt and incense, with a faint tang of electrical discharge.
"They shot at me," muttered the pilot. "Shot at me, as if I was some common mortal, not so much as a word."
The skulls clattered as he shifted in his seat, the sound of bone clacking against bone oddly out of place amongst the sophisticated instruments and dials.
"What?" said the pilot. "No, they had no idea. They will find out soon enough."
A trickle of seawater drizzled from one of the skulls, then beaded and floated away as the craft pushed its way free of the planet's gravitic envelope.
"I imagine they will, yes," the pilot continued. "They have proven tenacious. Those of you who are Mystai will understand that all too well. Besides, with the help of your talents combined, I intend to make my influence obvious."
A distorted sphere of brine wobbled past the pilot's tusked helm, trailing smaller droplets in its wake.
"The Scorpid," said the pilot gravely. "Let us visit the lessons of the past on those who would rather forget. Lessons some of you will understand well, old friends. We shall show them what it means to be unforgiven."
The skulls kept their peace. The black-winged craft shot on through low orbit and into space, its cargo of madness and death free in the void once more. Company Master Gabriel's face appeared on the interior of the Night Harrower's telemetry link for a static-laced second.
"We're to move out," he said. "Thunderhawks inbound."
His image then disappeared again. Morricone sat up sharply, combing his sandy hair with his fingers.
"Was that the dashing Master Gabriel?"
Farron laughed quietly.
"You'll get your chance to impress him soon enough, Peter. But I'd advise against trying to do so with your wit."
"But he seems such a light-hearted soul."
"Don't they all?" said Vesley.
"You know as well as I that they have good reason for their attitude," said Farron. "There's little room for levity in an active war zone."
"Certainly not with you as commanding officer," said Morricone.
"Cease,"
said Farron, consulting the skull-styled cogitator relay as it chattered out a studded length of parchment.
"We are still technically engaged, even if the enemy have fled. The chaplain wants us to rendezvous over open water in 33 minutes.
He thought about the debrief once more.
Various odd phrases and fragments of information played through his mind, over and over.
"But I have something I need to do before then," he said, standing up. "I need some answers."
"You're not going to try to confer with the other officers again, are you?" said Morricone.
"Not them," said Farron. "Someone else."
"Are you sure that's a good idea, Lieutenant?"
"Trust me."
Chapter 3. Trial and Error. Ferrogiant Omicroid, Saltai of X, Pelagic Industrial World, Chalnath Expanse. Omicroid's Seabrig looked a dank and lonely place. Held suspended 50 feet below the underside of the Promethium rig, the cuboid structure languished amidst a fog-like stench of unrefined fuel and rotting bivalves. The rough cork of its walls was discoloured by strata of algae and caked salt, and long strands of bladderwrack hung from its underside like the beard of an undersea god. Handhold by handhold, Farron swung by his arms under the rig's decking towards it. With his legs in a loose crouch, he had gripped the underside of the lower walkways by their grills and grate holes, reached out for thick pipes that looked solid enough to take his weight, and grabbed for the wrong hollows of each intermediate stanchion whilst ignoring the trickles of promethium drizzling from above. Thus far, he was making good progress. Behind him, the three repulsors were smudges of dark green in the distance. By Gazar's estimate, and Farron trusted that implicitly, the tanks were too tall to make it under the rig when their engines were active, failing to clear it by a matter of a few infuriating inches. Besides, where a repulsor made for an obvious sight, a single space marine had a chance of making it to the brig and back without being seen by inquisitive eyes. So, without so much as a moment's hesitation, Farron had taken the hard way. Ahead, the makeshift cell was a lump of dark, near solid black on the lieutenant's helm display. He could see a tiny trace of yellow through the air vents that hinted at the occupant inside. Doubt crept into his mind, the suspicion he should have stayed in the Harrower gradually coalescing in the shadows of his intent. But he could see no other way to the truth. Reaching the framework of girders around the brig, Farron moved hand by hand around its periphery, taking care not to move too close to the ladder stanchion that led towards its circular vault hatch. Above the brig was a grill. Above that, no doubt, was the occupant's jailer. His breath quickened, and he pushed aside the pain in his wounded side as his breath came heavier. The lieutenant knew he was taking a huge gamble in coming down here. He was risking being the brunt of another psychic attack, even by showing his face to the brig's occupant. But it was the thought of his superior's reaction if they found him questioning their prisoner that was making his twin hearts pound. He was almost certain they would settle the matter in violence, swift and final. The lieutenant dropped down onto the corner of the brig, taking care to crouch with his impact so he didn't smash the whole thing into the waves.
"Who's there?"
came a harsh, croaking voice, barely audible over the pounding surf.
"I've already told you everything I know."
Farron knelt down, then laid flat on his chest atop the brig, leaning forward over the edge so his face was level with one of the air vents.
"Zedro Farron, Lieutenant Primaris, assigned to the 3rd Company."
He caught himself for a moment.
"From the hearing room."
He could just about make out Deal in the darkness, huddled around a thermal battery that, according to his infrared, was all but drained of charge. Sitting there in a couple of inches of brackish water, she looked truly awful, her eyes staring white orbs in the shadows of a skull-like face.
"Sad to see the company master took his cloak back," said Farron.
"It looked better on him anyway. Are you here to kill me?"
"No," said Farron. "Simply to talk and check you're still whole in body and mind," he said.
"I'll be dead by nightfall."
"Did they torture you?"
"Yes. No, I don't know. I ache all over, especially my brain, and parts of my memory are just missing."
"Unfortunate," said Farron.
"We are to withdraw in the next..."
He checked his helm's chronometer.
18 minutes. "There will be an extraction, not too far from here. If you answer my questions quickly, I will leave the top of this brig open. You can climb out and begin to rebuild your home."
"They have what they need, Lieutenant," she said. "They won't leave Omicroid to freeze. It's too much of a liability. They'll torch this place as they go and let the cold take care of the rest.
Farron did not reply.
One day, my corpse might be found in the brig, I suppose. Maybe even identified. Evidence enough of mutiny, especially when the fact we colluded with the Tau comes to light.
That is the truth, is it not? Some might say you deserve punishment.
We had no choice. I already told you that. The whole thing will be put down to an insurrection rightly punished, its leaders slain by noble Adeptus Astartes, and the rest brought back into the imperial flock, just in time to die as dutiful sheep instead of vile heretics.
You have a strange way of looking at our rescuing of you from the Xenos that were attacking you, said Farron. I'm sure you'll be relocated from this planet and settled once more when your planet's winter cycle is over. I will make the arrangements myself, if necessary.
Emperor's throne, Farron. They will just let me die and not think twice about it. Why aren't your brothers visiting the other rigs then, if you're here to drive off the Xenos influence? I saw that black craft come out of its hiding place, fleeing for low orbit. You space marines had better get after it if you want to catch up.
What craft? What are you talking about?
The black-winged craft with the twin cannons. Impressive tech. Not many craft can play submersible, then breach from underwater and boost straight into the sky.
No such craft is part of the chapter's armory, said Farron. It must be navy.
Whatever you say, said Deal. It looked a good deal like the fighters pursuing it, and it had many of the same markings. Swords, wings, that kind of thing.
Really? Where was this craft heading?
Hard to say. It vanished within a few seconds of breach. Looked like it was headed for the Scorpid's Eye. That system's in roughly that direction. There's not much else within reach. The pilot was keen on escaping you, no doubt.
Falsehoods, said Farron quietly. This is delirium.
At this point, I don't much care if you believe it or not. I'm dead either way.
Farron looked back at the repulsor and glanced at his chronometer. 14 minutes. You know too much to just be left in here.
Is there any other choice? She spat. You kept me alive only to let me die.
Farron looked up at the grill, then down at the surging waves below the rig. They had risen in height and intensity in the last few minutes, and now they were crashing against the stanchions and the underside of the brig with a steady rhythm. The cold salt tang of their spume filled the air. Farron balled a fist and punched the vent as hard as he could, timing the impact just as a wave slapped against the underside of the cuboid to mask the noise. The metal buckled, one of the rusted-in screws along its length popping free. Another wave broke, and Farron levelled another punch, this time forcing an inch-thick hunk of metal to stick outwards. A third wave came in, and Farron grabbed the protruding flap of metal, tearing it half open with a dull clank. As he was drawing back for another punch, the entire thing came spinning away into the water below. The toe of Deal's boot jutted from the other side of the vent for a second, before disappearing once more. The hole they had made was too small for a human to fit through, but in tearing the metal away, Farron had crumbled some of the rebar support beneath it. He grabbed the jutting metal struts and yanked them back and forth, dislodging even more of the pebbled stone. Deal scrabbled at the mortar and slivers of rock from the other side. She scraped and pulled at the base of each strut, then took off her boot and used the steel toe cap as a hammer, slamming it repeatedly into the stonework. Scatterings of pebble-sized stones fell away. Gritting his teeth, Farron waited for the next wave to come in before violently wrenching the rebar left and right, clearing loose rock with his other hand and forcing jagged struts of metal aside with a grunt of effort.
"It'll do," said Deal. "Move aside. Please."
Farron checked his lens chrono. 8 minutes. He was lingering too long. Deal was already up at the vent's edge, reaching through to grab Farron's hand. He pulled her through as carefully as he could, but he could see her face was ashen with pain. She squeezed her hunched shoulders through the vent's widest part. He held his arm out, braced rock solid with his power armor's support, and she clambered onto it as if it were the bough of a tree until his forearm was under her waist. Then, shuffling forward, he reached out as she fought to get her hips through, allowing her to bring her legs up and out.
Grunting with effort, Diult climbed over his pauldron and backpack, smearing blood from the dozen cuts and grazes on her arms and legs across the dark green of his power armor. With a final effort, she slumped atop the brig with a heavy sigh.
No time for rest, said Farron. We need to move.
6 minutes left, and the waves were rising, getting fiercer.
Arms around my neck, said Farron. There's still a chance we can do this.
Biting her lip in exhaustion and frustration, Diult wrapped her arms around Farron's gorget, locking one hand on her wrist and the other to the underside of his chest plate. She pressed her body to his backpack, but to Farron, her weight was nothing.